If you have your Bibles, open them with me to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 23, and we'll begin reading in verse 26. Luke chapter 23, verse 26 through 31. A few years ago, in 2013, there was a man in South Carolina by the name of Larry Swilling, who, along with his wife, received the worst news of his life. The doctor told them that Mrs. Swilling was experiencing kidney failure. She'd been born with only one kidney, and so they knew that if she did not get a transplant, and relatively soon, she would not survive. The waiting list was far too long for them to have any realistic expectation of getting a kidney there. No one in their family was compatible to make a donation. They were desperate. And so Mr. Swilling decided to do something a little bit different. He decided to do something interesting. He decided to do whatever it took in order to save his wife's life. So he made for himself a large sandwich sign that said, "Need kidney for wife," with his phone number on the bottom. And Mr. Swilling started walking hundreds and hundreds of miles. He wound up needing knee surgery. He walked so much carrying that sign around. But thousands of people saw that sign, and thousands of people called that number. Hundreds of people got tested to see whether or not they were a match. And one man, a retired Navy lieutenant, was in fact compatible, and he donated the kidney that extended her life. 2,000 years ago, Jesus did something infinitely better. He started walking, not the roads of South Carolina, but the roads of Jerusalem, all the way to a place called Golgotha. And there he did what it took in order to save lost sinners like you and me. He donated not a kidney, but he gave his own life, shedding every drop of blood that he had, paying the price for us to be saved. In our passage this morning, Jesus' trial is over. He has now been handed over to be crucified. And we don't know how long it took for Jesus to take those steps leading up to the place where he died. But it's interesting for us to simply stand back and observe Jesus along the way. And we see some of the encounters that he had, some of the people that he met as he was on his way to the cross, some of the words that he spoke to them. And I believe that we're going to see this morning that there are some lessons that we can learn and some applications that we can make in our own lives as we are observing Jesus on his way to the cross. Now, the first thing we're going to see in this passage is a providential encounter. A providential encounter. Look with me at verse 26. As they led him away, they seized Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming in from the country, and laid the cross on him to carry behind Jesus. In the verse before, we're told that Pilate handed Jesus over. In the Gospel of Matthew and Mark, they add that Jesus was also flogged. He was scourged. That cat of nine tails I described to you last week. Normally, a man was sentenced to one or the other. He was flogged or crucified, but Jesus was given both. He was flogged and crucified. And so we see all of the violence that man is capable of is being unleashed upon Jesus. And I tell you, that was necessary. That was absolutely necessary for the death of Jesus to be as violent as possible. It was necessary because the cross meant the wrath of God being poured out on sin, God's disposition towards sin is wrath, because he is just, it should be wrath. And you have all of the wrath of a holy God stored up against sin being placed here upon Jesus. And at this point, there's an unexpected character who shows up in the story. And his name is Simon. We're told that he's from Cyrene. And he was forced to carry Jesus' cross. Now, normally, the Romans would force those being executed to carry their own cross. And they did this because it was part of the punishment. They wanted you to have to face all of those people as you carried that cross. They wanted you to have to hear all of the names that they called you and all of the insults that they hurled upon you. They wanted to make that route as long as possible. And they wanted to just drag it out. All of that was part of the punishment. It also served the purpose of striking fear in the hearts of the people, lest any of them think about rebelling. The only reason why, in this case, Simon was forced to carry Jesus' cross is because he had been flogged. His back was basically ripped to shreds, and more than likely, he carried the cross for as long as he could until he just didn't have the strength to take one more step. Now, Simon was a common name in Bible times. We know of 9 different men in the New Testament named Simon, but there was nothing common about this particular Simon. He plays a very unique role in the story of Jesus' suffering and death. In fact, there are some things that his life demonstrates for us. His life demonstrates for us the posture of a disciple. To the Romans, Simon was just the closest guy that happened to be standing there when they grabbed him and forced him to carry that cross. As far as they were concerned, here was a man who one moment was minding his own business and suddenly he was forced into service. There's a reason, though, we know Simon's name. There are other characters in this story who are not named, but Simon's name is given to us because Simon would have been known by those in the early church. They knew him. It will be very clear in a moment when we look at some of the other scriptures that Simon eventually became a follower of Jesus Christ. You know, on Friday, Billy Graham's funeral took place. One of his daughters, Ann Graham Lotz, wrote in a devotional what it must have been like for Simon of Cyrene to carry that cross. And I love the way she put it. Let me read to you what she said. What would it have been like to have shared in the humiliation of rejection as he was cast out of the city? What would it have been like to have felt the sticky warmth of his blood from the cross on your skin? What would it have been like to have felt the encroaching horror as the place of execution neared? What would it have been like to have seen the executioners who stood waiting impassively with hammers in hand? What would it have been like to have the burden of the cross lifted from your back as someone said, "This is his cross. You're free to go now." And he was nailed to it, not you. Indeed, we do wonder what that must have been like. You can see why for Simon the cross was something personal. When eventually he heard the preaching of the gospel, to Simon it had special meaning. When Simon heard someone talk about carrying the cross, he had done it. When he heard someone talk about the blood of Jesus, he had touched it. when he heard people talk about the love of Jesus, he had seen it. And at some point, probably at Pentecost, Simon was told why Jesus died on the cross. And in that moment, it all came together. It all made sense. And Simon of Cyrene became a follower of Jesus Christ. Now, he did not understand it at the time, but when the Romans forced him to carry that cross, he was, with his actions, acting out the call of Christ. We remember what Jesus said in Luke 9:23. If anyone wants to come with me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. And then he said in Luke 14:27, whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. We are called to do, in a spiritual sense, what Simon of Cyrene did in a physical sense. Jesus said, you must carry your cross. What does that mean? That means surrender. That means self-denial. That means you lay down your will and your agenda, your plans, for the sake of following Christ as Lord of your life. Now, Simon carried that cross for a while. When he got up to Golgotha, sure enough, that cross was taken from him and placed upon Jesus. And again, we see in that a picture of the gospel. That cross should have been his, and it should have been yours, and it should have been mine. And yet Jesus was placed upon it. He died in our place. So we see Simon in this moment forced to carry the cross, and in doing so, he's demonstrating the posture of a disciple. But when we look at Simon, we also see something else. We see him demonstrating a beautiful picture of the sovereignty of God. Luke barely mentions Simon's name, but there are other scriptures that give us more details about Simon and about his family and some of what they did. And if you take these different verses from the New Testament and you put them together, it's kind of like the different pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. I don't know how many of you ever play with a jigsaw puzzle or put them together. You have all these different pieces. And in this case, you take all of these pieces, and when you put them together, the picture that you see at the end, it's not a picture of Simon. What you see when you put it all together is a picture of the sovereignty of God. Luke tells us that Simon was from Cyrene. That was in North Africa, if you don't know, modern-day Libya. That's interesting because Simon would have been a part of that church that formed there in Cyrene. We know a few things about that church and what they did. In Acts chapter 11, verse 20, that church that Simon was almost certainly a part of, that church did something very, very significant. You know what they did? Listen to what it says. But there were some of them, Cypriot and Cyrenian men, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Hellenists, proclaiming the good news about the Lord Jesus. Men from Simon's church went to preach the gospel in a town called Antioch. You say, what's the big deal about that? Two chapters later, in Acts chapter 13, the church at Antioch, that church sent out two missionaries, Paul and Barnabas, on their first missionary journey. Did you know that Simon played a part in that? He absolutely did. You say, well, Pastor, how do we know that? Well, let's continue to take some of those pieces from the puzzle and put them together. In Mark's gospel, when he mentions Simon of Cyrene, he tells us that Simon was the father of two other men that, again, the early church would have known, named Alexander and Rufus. When Paul wrote his letter to the Romans, He was making his closing remarks in chapter 16. He actually sent a personal message to Rufus, Simon's son. You know what the Apostle Paul said to Rufus? He said in Romans 16, 13, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother and mine." Paul said that Rufus had been chosen in the Lord. And boy, there's a lot we could say about that. But notice this. Paul said, when you give greetings, make sure you greet his mother. Rufus's mother would have been Simon's wife, the Simon we see carrying the cross of Jesus in verse 26. And notice what Paul said about her: Rufus's mother and mine. Paul was not claiming that she was his biological mother. "And mine" means that she was like a mother to Paul. What a compliment! I mean, think about the impact that she must have made on Paul's life that he would make such a statement about her. Now, you take all that we know and you just add it all together. Simon carried Jesus' cross. Simon was saved. His wife was saved. At least one of his sons was saved and served the Lord. His church sent missionaries to Antioch. Antioch then sent out Paul and Barnabas. Barnabas, we know, took in Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark. That's why we have that. Paul wrote almost half of the New Testament. And Simon's wife was like a mother to the greatest missionary in the history of the church. Do you see all that God squeezed out of that man? The impact that his life had. Now, you're going to look at all of that and think that it was just some kind of accident that he was the man standing there. The Romans grabbed and said, "Hey, you carry that cross." Absolutely not. It was not a coincidence. It was not an accident. How many of you know there are no accidents with God? What there is a God who is in control of the smallest things that come into our lives and who will use all of that for his glory. God made sure the man who was standing there when Jesus could carry that cross no more was a man that he would use to make a great impact on his kingdom and to turn this world upside down for the gospel of Jesus Christ. I call that a providential encounter. There's something else that we see as Jesus is making his way to the cross. We also see a reason to mourn. A reason to mourn. Look at verse 27. "A large crowd of people followed him, including women who were mourning and lamenting him." These particular women that we read about in verse 27 were not the devoted women who followed Jesus, not those women who were the first ones there at the tomb on Easter morning. We're not talking about his mother Mary or Mary Magdalene. We're talking about a different group of women. In those days, there were women who were professional mourners. Someone died, they would show up at the funeral. That was their job, to mourn. These women would sometimes follow those who were to be crucified, crying and mourning and weeping in their path. Sometimes they might bring wine or opiates in order to dull the pain. Jesus, of course, refused that. Luke tells us that they were mourning and lamenting. That word for mourn literally means to beat the chest. That word lament is a word that is used on other occasions to describe a funeral dirge, to describe the singing of a song. These women were there to make a scene. They were there to add to the drama of the moment. It's possible these women had done this for many other men and women who had been crucified. But I guarantee you one thing, no one had ever said to these women what Jesus is about to say to them in the very next verse. Look at verse 28. But turning to them, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and your children." Can we just pause for a moment and reflect on how incredible it was that Jesus, in this moment, in spite of everything that he was suffering, would actually be thinking of others and not himself? Isn't that by itself pretty incredible? You know what we call that? We call that amazing grace. His flesh hung like threads. He was drenched in blood. He had a crown of thorns on his head. And Jesus was concerned for them. Don't you think for one moment Jesus doesn't care about you when you're struggling or when you're hurting. If he cared for them in that moment, then you can rest assured he cares about you. But think about this statement that he makes to these women. He says, "Don't weep for me, weep for yourselves and for your children." Now, let's be honest. When we read that, it does seem a little bit odd to us, doesn't it? Because when we read this story and everything Jesus suffered, of course we want to weep for Jesus. And yet, as bad as this is, as gruesome as the cross is, if you understand the cross, it does not cause us to mourn. The cross causes us to rejoice. We boast in the cross. We glory in the cross. So Jesus, on his way to Golgotha's hill, he turns to these women and he says, if you're going to mourn, if you're going to weep, do it for the right reason. And he's going to tell them what is the right reason to mourn. It's really like two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we mourn for the judgment the world faces. If we're going to mourn, mourn for that, Jesus said, for the judgment the world faces. Look at verse 29. Look, the days are coming when they will say, the women without children, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed are fortunate. Some translations say are blessed. Now, you need to remember that Jewish women in Bible days, they considered barrenness a curse. They did not consider it a blessing. None of them would have ever said barrenness is a blessing. But Jesus describes a future judgment that is coming, a judgment that will be so severe that when it comes, they will say, blessed are the barren. A judgment so severe, it will be considered better for those who do not have children. Now, we're going to come back to verse 30, but I want you to skip down to verse 31. For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? Now, that's a really interesting proverb right there. Jesus said, if this is what happens to green wood, or some translations will say tree, this is what happens to green wood, what will happen to dry wood? You think, what in the world does Jesus mean by that? What in the world does that have to do with the cross or them weeping or whatever judgment is coming. Well, let me explain it. A tree that was healthy was covered in green. And green trees don't burn very easily, do they? When you hear about a wildfire in the news, many times out in California, those wildfires, they never seem to happen in the midst of heavy rains, do they? Those wildfires always seem to happen during times of drought. Well, of course, there's a reason for that. When it's not raining, the wood gets dry. When the wood gets dry, it easily burns. In this illustration, in this proverb, Jesus is the green tree. He was holy. He was loving. He was gracious. He was merciful. He was kind. He was all of that. Jesus was the green tree. And Jesus turns to these women and says, "See what's happening to me?" What was happening to Jesus? Crucifixion, that's what. And then he makes this point. If this is what the green tree has to endure, if it's this bad for me, how bad will judgment be for those who reject God's loving, gracious offer of salvation through Jesus Christ? It will be beyond that, beyond horrible. Now, this judgment that Jesus is speaking of, it's a judgment that will fall upon the earth, but it's a judgment that will fall upon the person as well. This judgment that he's speaking of, this fire that burns the dry wood, it really alludes to the fires of hell. And there's a mourning that ought to take place in us when we think about the lostness of every friend, every neighbor, everyone we know who does not know Jesus Christ, because eternity is long and the stakes are high. If we're not mourning, then according to Jesus, something is wrong. We mourn for the judgment the world faces. But then the other side of that coin, we mourn for the hopelessness the world knows. We ought to mourn because of the hopelessness that this world knows. Go back to verse 30. "Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.'" Jesus was referring to the book of Hosea. Years before, Hosea had prophesied that the Assyrians would come. God would use them to judge the northern kingdom of Israel. And he said, when that judgment comes, it's going to be so bad. Here's what the people are going to say. They're going to cry out to the mountains and say, "Would you just fall on us?" They're going to cry out to the hills and say, "Would you just cover us up?" Now, that prophecy literally had already been fulfilled. But that expression became part of their vocabulary. And anytime they spoke of God's judgment, especially when it was especially severe, this is the phrase that they would use. Now, you could argue that this was fulfilled again in AD 70 when Jerusalem fell. And yet even that is a picture of what is to come. We read in the book of Revelation in chapter 6, after the sixth seal judgment, this is exactly what the Bible says. The people will say, there will come a time of tribulation when God's judgment on this earth is so harsh, is so severe, so difficult to endure. The people will cry out to the mountains and say, "Fall on us." But let me ask you a question. Just how bad does it have to be? How hopeless would a person have to feel that they would go outside and speak to a mountain and say, what I really want, what I really wish would happen right now, I wish that you would come over here and land on top of me. How hopeless must someone be? Now, I know this is not a very encouraging thought. Not one of you is going to go home today and say, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, Pastor Howard preached about mountains falling on top of us. Boy, that was that just great. Not one of you is going to say that. No, this is not something that we enjoy hearing. But Jesus believed that we needed to hear it. In fact, he believed it so much, he was willing to stop in his tracks on the way to the cross to make sure those women heard it and to make sure that through them we heard it as well. And it's as if Jesus is saying to them, you're mourning for me, but you need to think about the alternative. If I don't do this, if I don't lay down my life, if I am not sacrificed on that cross, this is all you have to look forward to, a future that is so bleak you don't even want to live. Folks, without Jesus, without the cross, that's all this world has to offer us. That's all we have to look forward to. You know, putting aside when this prophecy is going to be fulfilled for a moment, I guarantee you there are people who in their heart feel this way right now. It's how they feel. Maybe some of you right now, if you were really honest, you'd say, yep, that's what I would want. I know we don't have many mountains here in South Florida, but if some mountain could come, land on top of me and put me out of my misery. Make the hurt go away. What do you do? How do you respond? How do you go on? You remember where Jesus was. You remember where Jesus was heading. You remember the cross. Because Jesus died on that cross, and if your trust is in him because he took your place on that cross, you know what that means? That means whatever you're going through right now, your suffering is temporary and your glory is eternal. For you right now, this world is as bad as it will ever get, and for you, if you are a Christian, the best is always yet to come. Yes, we mourn when we think about the judgment this world faces. Yes, we ought to mourn when we think about the helplessness and the hopelessness that the people of this world know all around us, and that ought to motivate us to do everything we can to get the gospel to as many people as possible. But here's what I would call the final takeaway from this. Here's the final application. Here's what I really want to leave you with when I talk about this hopelessness that is all around us and how we mourn for that. Here it is. Jesus is the solution for a hopeless life. That's the good news. Yes, we mourn for this world. Yes, this world is pretty hopeless. And if you don't believe that, you need to pay more attention to the headlines recently. The world may be hopeless, but Jesus is the solution for a hopeless life. There's an old Steve Green song that we used to sing a lot. And I sang it a lot when I was a teenager, and we don't sing it as much anymore. But I think about the chorus to that song. The words could not be more simple. And yet I believe in a way it summarizes what Jesus is saying in these final verses. It goes like this. People need the Lord. Do you remember that? People need the Lord. At the end of broken dreams, he's the open door. People need the Lord. People need the Lord. When will we realize people need the Lord? Do you believe that? If people need the Lord, then we need to tell them.